The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. And today we do have open lines. And we'd love to hear from you, first of all, by phone, and second, by email. More about that in just a minute. So this will be a full-length program. So I do want to let you know, first of all, that we have a special guest with us to open up the show in a few minutes. So stand by for that. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then you can also post comments on our blog, which is thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right for upcoming shows. Click on the first show and open that page up. And then all the way down at the bottom, you can post your comments. You do not have to be logged in to discuss to do that. You can do so as a guest. And again, just for reminders, the preferred way is telephone 1-866-687-7223. Please note that the website newsletter for the new week will be uploaded shortly after this program ends today, and it will be posted on our homepage. You'll see it over there on the upper right side. And make sure you scroll down, and it'll show you all the additional programs we have now scheduled through the end of second quarter 2019. Remember, everything that we're doing is archived. You can quickly download shows or listen right off of our website. For those of you interested in Space Show logo wear, remember to click on any of the pictures on the website pages over on the right of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and that will take you to our Cafe Press Space Show page. Check it out. If you have any questions or comments or suggestions, please do let me hear from you. And then remember also, in the upper left menu is the Listen Live menu. So this tells you how to listen to a live Space Show program. Please share this information, by the way. It tells you how to listen to archives right off of our website, which are compressed MP3s, or podcast, including Alexa by Amazon. And if you have any questions about any of these formats, please let me hear from you, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And in addition, we are a 501c3 nonprofit listener-supported program, which means that with your contributions, we are able to bring you great guests, do open lines programs, talk to people like Henry Vanderbilt, who will be on in just a second, and do much, much more. It doesn't happen without your support, and we appreciate that. As a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, if you're paying U.S. federal taxes, then you get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. And if you have any questions, please check out OneGiantLeapFoundation.org and then email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. For those of you interested in being on the advisory board for the Space Show, email me at drspace@thespaceshow, and I'll give you the guidelines, although you can read the guidelines by going to OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, clicking on Teams, and when Teams open up, use the drop-down menu advisory board. And we'd appreciate your participation, so check it out. And again, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to get a hold of me. In addition to the individual support, we do sponsorships, and those sponsors get their ads running across the homepage, and you can change that ad as often as you like. In addition, on regular length programs like the one we're having today, I do read sponsor messages. So for the first segment, Moonwords has a message for all of you. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon, and they based it their decisions only on technical and economic merit. Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to find its development, to help, fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. The Space Foundation, wow, their symposium is here. It is April 8th through the end of this week, or almost the end of this week, Colorado Springs, thespacesymposium.org. If you're in the vicinity, it is not too late to register. Colorado Springs, Colorado, go to spacesymposium.org. Phenomenal networking. Don't miss it if you still have an opportunity, even at this late date. Northrop Grumman sponsors us. They're a leading global security company, providing innovative systems, products, and solutions to government and commercial customers worldwide. They offer extraordinary portfolio of capabilities and technologies. They go from undersea to outer space, and they include cyberspace. And then don't forget that for the first segment as well, AIAA sponsors us. This is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It's the world's largest aerospace professional society. And they have five events, which they call forums, per year. Amazing networking. They have a library of thousands of peer-reviewed papers that you can access for your research or your knowledge. Their membership works in the field, so they are the people actually driving aerospace engineering. And check it out at AIAA.org. I am a member, but as a non-engineer, so they do have non-engineering memberships. And again, incredible networking. And as I said, today is open lines. We'll have more about that in a few minutes. But we have special guests standing by to come talk to us about the Space Access Conference, which is now next week. Wow, the time has come. Henry Vanderbilt is back with us. And we're going to get a glimpse and a late last-minute update of what's happening. Henry, welcome back, and how are you doing, and have you gone crazy yet?
No, in no particular order. It's great to be here on the Space Show, David, and I must have gone crazy years ago or I wouldn't do these things. I had a temporary attack of sanity a few years back, but I got persuaded to come out of retirement, so I guess I'm still crazy, and it's going very well. We're in the last second rush, a week and a half out, trying to pin down a whole bunch of different details so when everybody gets there, it'll all run absolutely smoothly and people will think it's easy.
Any new guest or main speakers you want to tell us about since when you and Mike were on a couple of weeks ago?
I'm sort of in the position of a man in the middle of a forest. I can't really tell you much about the forest, but, yeah, let me see if I can recall who's actually showed up lately. We've got now NanoRacks Corporation that is a launch customer going to be speaking Thursday morning. Rich Pornell, their senior VP of business development, is going to come by and talk about the small sat launch market. Let's see.
By the way, listeners, if you want to talk to Henry while he's on the show with us this morning, you can call us on the toll-free number. And let me give that out to you one more time. It is 1-866-687-7223. Maybe you're still sitting on the fence and you need just a little nudge to jump over and attend the event, or maybe you have a question for Henry about the event. So while he's here with us this morning, he'll take your phone call. Again, 866-687-7223. Okay, Henry, back to you.
Yeah, there actually hasn't been a whole lot of change in the last couple of weeks. We had a really good schedule confirmed then, and we've had one or two additions and one or two cancellations. People's logistics just turned out not to work out, but it's still pretty good. The Thursday on a whole, we're looking at the entrepreneurial revolution in small sat launch. We've got a half dozen or more of the small sat launcher startups, Firefly, Rocket Lab. Exos Aerospace is going to be there with some interesting announcements. They just did a test flight of their reusable suborbital recently live on the Internet. It was a fairly impressive demonstration, especially the way they parachuted it back to a precision soft landing. CubeCab. Another new addition is Reaction Dynamics out of Montreal, Canada. They're working on a launcher that is by using 3D printing and a short supply chain. They're looking at building something that can launch small sats at an affordable price for the market with very short lead times. They'll be talking more about that. There's a couple of engine companies, too. Launcher comes to mind. They're going to be talking about a liquid oxygen-cooled 3D printed engine. 3D printed engines are happening all over the place. Liquid oxygen cooling is a little more advanced and exotic. Now, that's the Thursday. One other thing, we've got Rick Wills coming out to talk about the Base 11 Space Challenge, which is going to be a $1 million-plus prize for the first student-led team to design, build, and launch a liquid-fueled rocket to space. Excuse me. And that is a quick summary of the Thursday. Friday, we've got a program changed. One of the features of our Friday is we have a little company called SpaceIL going to Skype in and talk about a recent project of theirs you might have heard about. They now have the world's first private commercial lunar lander mission in orbit around the moon and scheduled to land in, I believe, 4 more days on the 11th. Do a relatively short on-moon mission, and then presumably they're going to catch up on sleep for several days and then Skype in. That probably won't be the first thing Friday morning. We're going to be shuffling that around to a different time of the conference. It's part of the sort of thing we do at this point. You know, people look at the schedule and realize, oh, they've got a schedule to go on. When? Well, that's not going to work. And we, you know, do last-second swaps and shuffles to fit everybody in at times they can actually be there and talk. But we're really looking forward to hearing from SpaceIL, keeping our fingers crossed for all the best success over the next few days of their mission. So far, they're doing really well. You can find some pictures that have been taken of the far side of the moon on the web over the last day or two. Other things going on the overall theme on Friday, coming soon, reusable rocket transport nets in cislunar space. And a couple of my colleagues have prodded me to add, you know, and you know, Earth-Mars space and nearby asteroidal space. The overall theme of the day is going to be that we can actually get to those places affordably, you know, interstellar system relatively near Earth, with the moon obviously being the first big step because it's the closest, but the others also within reasonable distance via, you know, current technology rockets. The one tricky bit is, as usual with rockets, if you throw them away after every mission, it gets expensive very quickly. And reusing them when you're going to places away from Earth, it gets a lot more difficult. You start having to arrange for fuel supplies at the far end of a run. We're going to be digging into those issues in depth on the Saturday. A bunch of companies, SpaceIL, as I said, other lander companies. There's a company called Orbit Beyond, Altius Space Machines that works on related technologies. Momentous Space, you know, works on water plasma in space propulsion. Agile Space Propulsion, also working on that sort of thing. Tethers Unlimited, which works on, you know, orbital transfer technologies and a bunch of on-orbit operational technologies. The core of our Saturday is going to be some gentlemen who, all of whom have their own views on what you might call Earth, Moon, Mars rocket, you know, reusable rocket transport ecosystem. If you're going to make the rockets affordable, they have to be part of an overall system that includes transfer points and refueling depots and fuel sources, including from water ice on the moon as soon as we can. Until then, you know, trucked up from Earth in heavy lift launches. But the thing is, at the moment, we've got, you know, several potential plans. You know, SpaceX obviously is going to form the Starship and the heavy lifter and running and refueling the Starship in low orbit and carrying it on to the moon and Mars is the planning to. And, you know, given SpaceX's tendency to, you know, be vertically integrated and not really count on anybody else, they're probably going to form their own ecosystem there. NASA has got plans for, you know, going back to the moon and building a building the Gateway Station in an orbit around the moon as a transit point and so on. And that's inevitably going to form some sort of an ecosystem.
You have a caller wanting to talk to you. You want to take the call?
Oh, sure. Okay. Sure. I can get back to this monologue anytime.
Okay. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? And you're on with Henry.
Hey, hi, this is Terry Inquiro.
Hi, Terry.
No, hi, Terry.
Hi. Hi. Space IL, I'm really excited about it. I'm really happy for the company and hope everything goes well. Do you know if they're going to have a live broadcast of the landing itself?
I do not know. From what I know about the logistics of such things, I honestly don't even know what the plans are for communications. You know, I don't know if they're going to have. I honestly don't know if they're going to be doing it on an automated basis, or with any sort of, you know, monitoring and command from the ground, or how they're going to go do it. From my experience with doing large projects with small companies, and stretching resources to the max, it's entirely possible that, you know, there won't be that much in the way of a live, you know, live broadcast from them, but I'm purely speculating. I don't know is the short answer.
And what is the speculation on how long they think it'll actually last on the surface?
What I've read in the news reports, I haven't talked to Space IL a great deal. Oddly enough, they're really, really busy over recent weeks. What I've read in news reports is that it's designed to last for 2 or 3 days on the surface. I believe, I wouldn't swear to this, that it's battery powered. Now, there are technical issues with making anything on the lunar surface last through a lunar night. It has to both, you know, tolerate the extreme cold soak for 2 weeks and be able to power up again afterwards. And that's a very difficult technical problem. And since this was originally designed in response to the Google Lunar X Prize, which didn't require that, they apparently don't have that capability. So it's going to be a relatively short mission once it's on the surface.
Well, I think we're all looking forward to it. And I appreciate you being on the show this afternoon. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Terry. Appreciate hearing from you.
Thanks for checking in.
So, listeners, if you want to call and talk to Henry, it is 866-687-7223. I looked on the Space IL website while Terry was on the phone, and there's absolutely nothing about live streaming the landing, not on any of their subpages, not anything that I could find, not even anything close to a title or a subtitle or anything that would even make you think that way. It's a cool website, but there's just... My hunch is that they're not able to streamline to show the landing.
Yeah, purely as a guess. You know, given what a magnificent thing they're doing with you know, by previous standards, ridiculously small resources. You know, asking for a major league media effort on top of it is probably asking a little bit too much. We'll be really glad to talk to them once they're done and they've caught up on sleep.
Yeah, and I'm hoping to get them on the show, but they've now put me on hold until after the landing, which is normal.
I can entirely understand that at this point.
But, you know, listeners, if you're really interested, go to their website. They've got cool pictures of their control room and all about what they're doing. I mean, you think it's a little bootstrapped effort, but it's pretty damn sophisticated. And when you see their control room and some of the other things that they're showing on their website and their videos and simulations, it is beyond the word impressive, in my opinion. So
I would expect that, you know, to whatever extent the information's available on an ongoing basis, this is going to get really good coverage on the web, on the specialized sites. The information that is available probably will be out there for us to follow. But we'll see.
Yep. There's not even anything showing that they're live streaming from the control room or anything like that. So I don't know. If they are, they haven't made it public yet.
Whatever information is available, I'm sure the usual suspects will be putting it on the web for us as quickly as they can.
Absolutely.
Getting back to the...
Go ahead. Yeah.
getting back to Saturday's program, talking about rocket transport networks as rocket transport ecosystems, we've got a couple of fairly distinguished speakers talking about that. Dallas Beanhoff used to be with Boeing, worked these issues a lot. I ran into him through the ULA people a while back. He's now got his own company called Cislunar Space Development Company, and he's going to be talking about, elements of the Cislunar transport net, space tugs, moon shuttles, and propellant depots. He's in the business right now. John Schilling is going to be approaching it from somebody we've known a long time, spoken a lot of space access. He's not necessarily that high-profile, well-known a person, but he's very good on these technical issues. He is going to be looking at what we can actually do in terms of putting payloads into deep space, translunar injection, trans-Mars injection, nearby asteroids, and so on. They're all rather similar. He's going to be looking at what size payloads we can do with current and near-term launchers. He's also going to be taking a look at the information that's available so far about the NASA Gateway and what NASA's thinking in terms of the transport and what that implies. This is necessarily speculative, but he's going to go on and talk about at least one potential flexible approach to meeting the parameters as best he can figure them out at this point, and possibly something flexible enough to go on to do more ambitious missions as well. John Goff is currently running Altius Space Machines and specifically is a small contractor focusing on specific systems for in space operations. He's going to be talking about that. But he also has a sideline, is fairly expert on in space propellant depots and propellant transfer issues and so on. Anyway, the three of those are going to be sitting in on a panel discussing cislunar transport ecosystems. And long story short, they're going to be looking at the prospects for encouraging interoperability and standards as various such systems evolve. So with luck, we'll reduce the chances that we end up with a whole bunch of completely independent, completely incompatible systems out there. That organization A may actually have a chance of getting propellant from depot B and vice versa if a situation comes up where that's compatible as opposed to where that's necessary as opposed to, having incompatible connectors 250,000 miles from home. We're going to start discussing that whole subject. In general, what goes into these ecosystems, who's heading in what direction, what the prospects are, as I said, for, starting to try to build a base of standards and at least getting the discussions going. I think that's a really good thing to be talking about because all of this, one way or another, is going to be happening soon. And the more thought we put into it, the better it'll like the conference. The more thought and planning we put into it, the smoother it's likely to go. Get to Saturday night, and we go to a couple of slightly different things. We're talking about, we've got some old friends from the Space Studies Institute talking about, in the post-dinner time slot, Space Studies Institute, past, present, and future. Old friend Lee Valentine's going to be talking about SSI's history. There have been a lot of interesting places since the days of trying to make, when they first started trying to make Gerard O'Neill's visions become real. Gary Hudson, president of SSI, is going to be talking about SSI's future direction. And Robin Snelson will then be talking about the conference SSI is doing in Seattle next summer. Apparently, I'm not alone in being talked out of retirement. It's been a few years since SSI did a conference also. They're going to be doing one in Seattle sometime late next summer, early fall. We've always figured SSI and space access have complementary missions. We work on making it affordable to get there. They work on the arrangements needed once you are there. How do you go about mining and refining things and fabricating things and building habitats at a reasonable price and keeping them habitable and so forth. We're glad to support them. We're giving them a time slot the Friday evening. They'll be talking about what they're up to. We follow that with a bit of history. A panel discussion called How to Save Civilization and Make a Little Money, subtitled, "This is All Jerry's Fault." a lot of you will have heard the name Jerry Parnell at one point or another. He's a fairly famous science fiction author, a fairly famous computer columnist. Some of us know him from both communities. What's a little bit less known is for a long time, 70s and 80s, especially, he was very active in the pro-space community. Towards the end of that time, mid to late 80s, Jerry was instrumental in getting the DCX flying, which in turn was instrumental in getting the concept across that you could, in fact, build and operate reusable rocket ships and land them again and then fly them again a day later without, you know, spending a major slice of the national budget or having, you know, 3,000 people on the payroll and standing around supervising different aspects of the project. They did it for something on the rough order of $100 million, and the operating crew was on the rough order of a couple of dozen. The DCX never went very high and very fast, and eventually, through some difficult circumstances, they ended up breaking it. But it changed a lot of people's minds, and frankly, it would not have happened without Jerry Parnell, and we will be having a panel discussion with a half dozen or so people who were there and working with them at various aspects of this time, and just talking about, you know, what was going on, how he was involved, what he was up to, The way I put it there is that 40 years ago, if you walked into a venture capitalist's office and told him you wanted him to put money into commercial rockets, you know, his answer would be security, get this loon out of my office. These days, you go into a venture capitalist's office and the answer is a lot closer to commercial rockets. How much you want? Jerry is a big part of that transition. We're going to be talking about that. Anyway, we get to the Sunday. Yeah, that's the fun. Well, it's all fun stuff. If you don't think this stuff's fun, well, you're listening to the wrong radio show. Sunday, we're talking about after rockets getting there faster. Chemical rockets are really amazing machines. They're one of the most efficient machines around, viewed from a certain aspect, and they probably are enough to get us to the inner solar system if we work them right. But they start hitting limits at that point. There's only so fast you can go with them without specialized, very expensive tricks, you know, multiple throwaway stages and planetary slingshots around Jupiter and that sort of thing. You can get a little bit of extra benefit, but there's still a top end. You know, they still take months to get to the inner solar system beyond the moon, days to the moon, months to Mars or the inner asteroids, you know, years to the outer solar system is pretty much the ballpark for conventional rockets. Getting to any of these places, a couple of days to the moon is tolerable. You know, months to Mars, well, with, you know, what we don't know yet about the irradiation in the zero-G environment and so on, getting that down to weeks would be better. You know, years to the outer solar system, well, if we can get that down to months, it would be a lot more likely to be able to, you know, start expeditions out there. The thing about getting there faster is you have to increase the amount of energy you're handling really drastically. It's, you know, MV squared. There's a squared term in the energy versus velocity. If you want to double your velocity, you need four times the energy. If you want to quadruple your velocity, you need 16 times the energy. And handling that much energy without the machinery that's handling it, you know, melting, requires either really heavy machinery to be that efficient, really highly efficient, 99.9% efficient machinery. Well, in the case of rockets, they have a lot of natural coolant running through them. For machinery that, you know, does higher energy propulsion without all that rocket propellant flowing through them, the coolant, they either have to be incredibly efficient or you have to move a lot of the energy handling off board from the ship and put it back at, you know, the transit stations. Not to give away any surprises, we're going to be talking about all of that, what it actually takes. The third alternative, of course, is once you've got unobtainium that can stand infinite temperatures with zero weight, you can build your, you know, nuclear-powered spaceships that zip around the galaxy like the Millennium Falcon. It's really cool. The technology to build those isn't there yet and won't be for a long time. In terms of what we can do over the next few decades to start, you know, getting ourselves around the solar system a lot faster than rockets will let us, we'll be spending a lot of Saturday talking about that. Pretty much the capper to it all is we've got a talk from a little outfit called Breakthrough Starshot, that is working on building the tech base for a near-term interstellar probe, essentially things working on machinery that we can build in our lifetimes that will allow us to send a nano probe out at about 20% of the speed of light and actually get data back without waiting for a future generation. And then his boss, Pete Worden, former head of NASA Ames, former head of, and worked various space issues in the DOD also, is currently the chairman of the Breakthrough Prize Foundation. He'll be talking about some things we might be able to do with that Starshot capability once we've got it. And at that point, we wrap up three extremely intense days on space transportation, you know, current, near future, and the longer-term prospects. And probably all repair to the whole hotel bar and have a few beers and talk to each other about what we've just heard for the rest of the evening. And that'll be a space access conference. You all should come by and check it out.
And then Sunday you have sort of an impromptu breakfast, right?
Well, that'll probably... that's been evolving. The arrangements with the hotel turned out to be less firm than we thought. It's evolving towards is we'll probably have discount tickets for breakfast in the hotel restaurant, which we'll hand out to people. So effectively, anybody who comes and hangs out in the hotel restaurant is before they head out the door and head to their flight home or drive home or whatever it is, we'll find a lot of the people from the conference hanging out in the restaurant. So it'll be one final chance to schmooze and network.
Is the hotel totally booked? Where would people stay now if they want to register late?
The hotel still actually has some rooms at our rate. It's an interesting situation. It's the Marriott Fremont Silicon Valley on Landing Parkway. Landing Parkway in Fremont, California. There's another Marriott courtyard or something nearby. Don't get confused. You want the Fremont Marriott Silicon Valley on Landing Parkway. Actually, the easiest way to get information is to look at the website space-access.org, and you will find a pointer to the latest information there, and that will have space-access.org. It's an ancient 90s-style primitive website. I've decided I'm an old curmudgeon, and I'm enjoying it.
It works, doesn't it?
It was good enough in the late 20th century. It's good enough now. And while you're at it, get off my lawn, you darn kids. Getting back to the subject, space-access.org, there'll be a link there for the latest conference information that'll have the full program schedule as it evolves. It mostly evolved now, still a few tweaks, as I said, and it'll have information on the hotel. There are still rooms at our rate in the Marriott. The deal is weekday rooms in the Marriott that aren't at our rate are extremely expensive. Weekend rooms, because it's a holiday weekend, not so much. But overall, if you want to stay there for several days straight, our rate is the best deal still. And the rate is still available through this Wednesday the 10th. And there are some rooms. As of a day ago, there are at least a few rooms available for all four nights of the conference. Unfortunately, you have to phone the hotel. You can't do it on the web. You have to phone the hotel and play touch tone tag and get to a live reservations person at the hotel to get our rate. Yeah, the instructions are on the website. But at that point, ask them. There's a reasonable chance they'll have rooms for all the nights you want, and take it from there. So there are rooms. Online registration for the conference is still up, too. You can see that at the website. That'll be up there through April 12th, Uri's night. After everybody in Bay Area staff recovers from the Uri's night partying, they're going to get together the next day and start printing up conference badges for the pre-registered people. We are past the advance registration discount. The rate you would get online is the same rate you'd get at the door now. The advantage, of course, is if you register online, you'll have a badge waiting for you, and that should be a shorter, quicker line to get through once you're there.
Okay.
So. Yeah, that's the short story. That's the short version of the conference, space-access.org. There's a link near the top of the page that'll take you to the latest conference information and schedule and all that good stuff. Hope to see you all there.
Well, look forward to seeing you there as well, Henry, and everybody else, and really looking forward to it. And thanks for giving us this update this morning.
Well, thanks for giving me the chance to come on and talk about the conference. I think it's pretty cool.
Always, we'll see you. Always a pleasure. We'll see you in about 10 days or something like that, right?
See you all late next week.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Listeners, if you want more information, do go to their website. I'm planning on being there. Probably a lot of people you know will be there. And I hope to meet those of you that I don't know in person. I love meeting spatial listeners in person. We are doing open lines, and I can throw out a couple of suggested topics to see if anybody wants to follow that tough act with Henry. And by the way, there is absolutely no truth to the rumors going around that there will be a special Sunday morning space access Easter egg hunt. I forgot to ask Henry about that, but I'm sure that that's just a rumor. So don't, if you're getting those emails, kind of ignore them. A couple of things to mention that you might want to talk about is more on Space IL and their projected lunar landing on the 11th. There is a film that has been made and will be coming out in the near future called Lucy in the Sky. Maybe some of you have heard about this. This is a story about Lisa Nowak's berserk behavior in her love triangle. She's a NASA astronaut at the time with a couple of other astronauts driving nonstop from Houston to Orlando to kidnap and do in the lover of who she thought was her lover. She wouldn't even stop to go to the bathroom, so she wore special diapers. It got a lot of play. We had a lot of jokes on the space show about it. But what is interesting is there is an entertainment website. I think it's popsugar.com/entertainment, but I'm not sure, that interviewed the producers or the directors about this story, which to me is a non-story. I can't imagine that anyone would make a film. And by the way, I saw the trailer of it, and the trailer convinced me that I would not be seeing the film. But they, in the film, put the blame on Lisa's behavior of being impacted adversely by the overview effect. So this is a pretty hard pill to take, because even if you're a skeptical person about the overview effect, I don't think anyone out there would claim the overview effect would drive you to mental instability to want to kidnap and kill the lover of the person you thought was your lover, and on and on and on. I did mention it to Frank White, who was aghast, as was I. But maybe some of you want to talk about that. I just find it really hard to believe that anybody with a straight face would put the overview effect as the reason for Lisa's really weird and bizarre behavior. But that did happen, and you can find it in one of the interviews on the web. So I don't know what else to say. If anybody plans on seeing that film, let me know. And if anybody does see that film, I'd like to hear from you about that, okay? A couple of other things that we could talk about. Let's see. As I said, there's more about Space IL, and if that's a topic that is of interest to you, we can certainly explore their moon landing in detail. I am trying to get them on the show, but we'll have to wait now until after the landing. Bob Zubrin responded with an op-ed to the Mike Pence NASA Lunar Lander Initiative that was announced a couple of days ago to get back on the surface of the moon by 2024. You can read Bob's announcement, or his op-ed as you would describe it, on the Mars Society website, and it's from the end of March. You'll find it easily. And Bob is coming on the show in the next couple of weeks. You can also ask about it when he is on the show. And then, of course, there is the statement that Bridenstine made on returning to the moon in the next 5 years. Many of you have seen that. I saw your email. And you may want to comment on that today as well. There was also, in the middle of March, a notice that was put out that there were latent viruses that could become active with long-duration spaceflight. And one such virus that they were warning about for astronauts getting reactivated was the herpes virus. So some of you may have read this. It was it got a lot of wide coverage, and this is the first open line show since that announcement came out, so we haven't really mentioned it on earlier shows. But if somebody's interested in that, that's a topic for discussion. The SpaceX hexagon tiles for the Starship heat shield passed a really important test. Some of you may have followed that, and you may want to talk about that. And then a publication called The National Interest rewrote a story from a couple of years ago that was in a Cold War book, and for the moment I forget the name of the book, but I'll probably remember it in a minute. And during the Cold War, we now learn that there were plans by both the United States and the Soviet Union to blow up nukes on the moon as muscle-flexing PR statements for both countries. And it's a summary is in the National Interest today, and it's called Cold War Crazy. America and Russia both had plans to nuke the moon. But again, this is from a story in a book that appeared a couple of years ago, but this is the first time I read about it, and it is bizarre, and some of you may be familiar with this and want to talk about it. We do have a caller on hold for Open Lines, so hello, caller. Welcome to Open Lines. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
Hello, David. It's Michael, listener here in New Hampshire.
Hi, Michael. How you doing?
Doing good. Doing good. Can't complain. Hey, I thought the announcement there about the return of the moon by 2024 was pretty interesting, to say the least, and a pretty gutsy move. I'm kind of interested to see how that plays out.
You really think that it's going to be doable when Congress actually produces their budget?
I don't know. That's what we're waiting to see. You know, because right now they have the purse strings, so they're the ones who got to give it the right to check for it.
Well, I'm skeptical, and the new chairman of the House Oversight Committee has said that they're going to put a lot of oversight onto this. They don't really see that there needs to be any more money going to this, or there's any reason to speed up going to the moon or anything like that. So my hunch is that the actual budget that gets produced, assuming that they create a budget, won't have anything to do with what President Trump submitted or suggested. And I do not think space and returning to the moon will have near the priority coming out of the House side that it has for the National Space Council and for people who listen to this space show program.
Oh, I don't think so either. That's mostly about politics anyways.
Well, that's, I think, where it all hinges on. It's not technology. They could do it if they really wanted to do it, and if they missed 2024, they could do it fairly soon after that, 2025, maybe 2026. But it's all about policy and money. I'm skeptical, and I hope I'm wrong.
Well, I think, I was just interested in the whole idea of it, is in that, it seemed like they were laying down the gauntlet to NASA, saying, look, show us what you can do.
And they got to do something other with the Gateway. I don't know if you heard the Dennis Wingo show on Friday, but he's very optimistic that it can happen. But he said it won't happen if it's NASA only. And the only prayer in hell of us getting back to the moon in 2024 or pretty quickly thereafter is that they've got to have a really innovative, different kind of partnership with these new private companies to make it happen. But
that's the way I think it's going to run.
Yeah.
And it was funny because Pence basically said we're going to target for the southern latitudes near the south pole of the moon, and people were saying, oh well, this is the first time a policy determination been actually laid out for an exact location. And I'm trying to say, look, water ice. This seems to be, indicate the possibility that this isn't just to go back just for a show, an election year issue, but actually, make a permanent, start a permanent installation on the moon. You have the South Pole, there's been a lot of water ice detected right there, and you can live off the land right there.
Well, he said he made a big point of them saying everything was on the table, and he interprets that as meaning even the gateway as currently planned is on the table. And we'll see. But if for those of you who really want to see an alternative or how 2024 might unfold, if it's going to become a real program, I would urge you to listen to Dennis's program. It's 68 minutes long. He was only on for about an hour, and that's from this Friday morning. And I don't know. Let's keep our fingers crossed. But boy, I just don't know what that budget will look like unless they go. They may even go on CR again, and then I don't know what would happen.
I don't expect the budget to get passed this year.
So they'll be on a continuing resolution.
Because you have another presidential election year coming up right now, and things just are rapidly political right now. They won't get a budget. There'll be more CRs. I'll be surprised if we even get an authorization act for NASA this year. Yeah.
Well, you may be right. So then they just continue on with what's in place right now.
That would make 3 years straight that NASA. I think it's almost 3 years straight that NASA hasn't had an authorization act passed.
Uh huh.
So it's just rapidly political, and you know, and right now this year especially with a presidential election cycle coming up, it's going to be amped up even more. So yeah, I don't expect much in that, but you know what, you never know what can happen, and I'm just kind of curious to see how it plays out. I'm kind of wondering how the Canadians feel about the announcement, because their new space strategy just was brought out, and one of their big things right at the top is participation in Lunar Gateway, and their budget act, I believe, actually has money to actually move forward with that program. So they're kind of probably scratching their heads, wondering, well, if the U.S. is going to go back to the moon by this date, is that mean they're going to scrap Lunar Gateway? So that's something else that kind of caught my attention as well.
Well, there's a lot of questions there in a very politically charged environment. So we'll see what happens. Marcia Smith is going to be on to talk about the budget issues and kind of give us a realistic picture, and she'd be a good one on May 3rd to ask about NASA authorizations and her take on it from sitting inside the Beltway. I will see her hopefully in June at ISDC. She's not going to attend the event, but hopefully we can have lunch together and maybe I can pick her mind for some inside the Beltway stories. We'll see.
Yeah, I saw Marcia last September or October, one of those two. But yeah, like I said, interesting times nonetheless, and there's so much going on right now. I mean, the past couple of weeks just been slammed with, you know, space-related issues, that it's just really been absolute whirlwind.
Do you think Israel having a successful landing with their lander on the 11th would impact Congress in wanting to support going back to the moon?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't think it will, just for the simple fact that, like I said, we're, you know, it's about the politics and really not about, you know, what is practical or what may be beneficial. That the equation is heavily weighted in politics right now.
So true. So. Okay, what else, Michael?
You know, a lot of stuff. We haven't actually talked in a while, and so why don't you send me some dates and I'll. Pencil something in to come in and talk.
Okay. I'll get you some dates later today. I'm booking through the end of July right now.
Yeah, July is probably going to be when it will probably be a good time for me to actually come by.
Okay. I'll send you some dates later on. Thank you, Michael,
right,
for your call.
Yeah.
Okay. Listeners, Michael has cleared the line. If you would like to give us a call on today, open lines, it is 1-866-687-7223. Any and all topics are welcome: space, science, STEM, STEAM, something related. We want to hear from you. First time callers are always welcome, but all callers are welcome. So, again, we do definitely want to hear from you, and we have another call, and let's see who's calling. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to Open Lines. Who are you? Where are you?
This is Marshall, Oklahoma, and earlier you mentioned latent diseases that are breaking out while people are in orbit or
I didn't say that,
places.
No, they're not breaking out. They have found that there is a likelihood of latent diseases reactivating on long-duration space flights. But as I recall, because this was from earlier in March, it had not happened yet, but they discovered a risk for it to happen and for it to likely happen, and they specifically identified the herpes virus.
Well, when I was reading it, I basically had an immediate thought to chickenpox and the shingles.
Well, that's herpes. That comes from the same root.
Yeah, same root, and it's kind of like, oh, yeah, boy, that is painful, and it really can cut down the amount of work you can do, et cetera, et cetera. And along that same line, I had thoughts of people having arthritis and autoimmune diseases like allergies that, you know, your system is designed to ward off, you know, a certain amount of disease and so on like that.
Uh-huh.
And if it isn't there because you're in space, there's no background for it to come to, all of a sudden you could have autoimmune diseases. Now, I understand that the astronauts are pretty well picked over to make sure they don't have those kind of problems, but somewhere down the road, somebody's going to have to go out and find out how that works.
Well, it hasn't happened on space flights yet.
Yeah,
but,
well, there's very few people that's been there.
But they haven't done much beyond low Earth orbit, and they haven't really done long-duration type of flights.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine most, boy, this is a big assumption, that it really is based on nothing. So we shouldn't even try it as an assumption. But I would think, let me rephrase it, that most astronauts probably had chickenpox as a kid.
Yep.
And so that means they are at risk as they get older for shingles.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure I understand the connection with herpes and chickenpox, but I know it's there. They're part of the same virus. But just because you had chickenpox doesn't mean you're going to end up with herpes. But I've gotten vaccinated against shingles, and so that could probably be taken care of, assuming the vaccination is effective for low Earth orbit, for microgravity and for space. I don't know that that's ever been tested. In fact, I would venture to say it never has been tested.
I agree with that. That's where I'm kind of leading. There's a whole series of these types of things, and there's been absolutely no testing. There's, you know, it's like, well, it's not happened so far, and it's not that big of a problem. It's way down on the priority list. But at least it's nice to know it's on the priority list.
I don't know. The adults I know that have gotten shingles tell me it is a living total hell.
I can swear to that one, yes.
And it takes ages, meaning maybe years, to get rid of it. It is not easy to deal with. So, which is why I bit the bullet on the two shot, very, very painful, brand new herpes shingles vaccine called Shingrix, which of course is in very short supply. You have to hunt to find the damn stuff. But the testimonials I got from people who have it, it's a nightmare problem. I don't know anyone that has chickenpox as an adult, but I remember it was hell as a kid, and back in my day, we had to wear gloves while we had chickenpox, so we couldn't scratch ourselves and break open the blisters and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's treated the same way today or not.
Well, they've had better, but you and I are not that far apart, and yeah, they shuffled whole grade schools around to avoid chickenpox.
But
they isolated people.
Yeah, so now it's in your system. So if there's something about long duration space flight and microgravity and radiation that might reactivate this into shingles or herpes, I would say the astronauts would be pretty pissed off.
And so
would the crew.
There's not too many guys over like 65 to go into space, so they're, you know, their age helps a lot too.
I guess, but as I said, I bet a lot of them did have chickenpox when they were kids. So.
Oh, yeah. I agree with that. I basically had the shingles for about 2 weeks, very painful, and then about 2 months later, I found out they had the shots for it.
Well, I listen, if people, if you're vulnerable to shingles, I would really, I mean, I'm not a doctor, so I can't give anybody medical advice, but really talk to your doctor about getting vaccinated, because I hear it is just hell on wheels if you get shingles.
I agree. I had a very miserable 2 weeks.
And nobody comes to tell me what getting herpes is like, so I have no clue what that, if they get that, I guess they keep it to themselves, but I don't know about that. But anyway, there might be other viruses that get activated in space flight that, so who knows if this will go anywhere, and I don't know how to, I don't even know how you research it without actually having on the job experience.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. Like the general cure for leprosy, they had to have a species that they could test on, which happened to be armadillos. And, you know, latent virus infections that can reemerge. Boy, I don't know of any animal other than humans that have that problem.
Well, hopefully it's an overstatement of concern by the researchers, but I guess that's another thing we'll find out about someday.
Yeah. That's all the fun I have for today. Let somebody else talk.
Thank you, Marshall.
Bye.
Marshall, everybody, has cleared our line. If you would like to give us a call on anything, not just the topics I suggested up front, but maybe then also you want to talk about the overview effect driving people mad and causing the Lisa Nowak syndrome. Maybe that's what they're going to call it. 1-866-687-7223. And we would love to have your calls. While we're waiting, I'm going to take us on pause. Well, no, I'm not, because we have another caller already. So stand by, everyone. Welcome to the show, caller. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. Go for it.
Now, the first thing I wanted to point out is that I posted a video on the blog that was about a demonstration of an artificial gravity room in a university near Boston, you told me it was.
Yeah, Brandeis University.
Yeah, it's really eye-opening to actually see the effects on somebody who's in that lab for the first time. And it looked like the room was maybe 30 feet across, like 6 meters, 8 meters, maybe 10. You know, large enough that you aren't going to launch anything larger than that in the foreseeable future. Anywhere. Once the guy who was taking this experience for the first time was in there, and he tries to move his arms, and they go off to the side, and they throw a ball, and then it goes in a really weird arc, and then they stop it, and just after a few minutes in this device, this guy, he has trouble adapting to a regular environment. Moves his arm, and now they're going off to the side again because he learned how to move them to the side inside that rotating room. Really interesting. Just a very interesting thing to think about, that artificial gravity is really important, but it doesn't solve all your problems.
Yeah, it's an excellent demonstration of the Coriolis effect at work, but it starts spinning the room, and I'll tell you, if they had kept spinning it and I'd kept watching it, I would have gotten dizzy. So I guess I'm susceptible to that, but I'm going to try to get them to come on the show and talk about it. You also mentioned that New Mexico has a similar kind of artificial gravity chamber or something, New Mexico State, right?
Yeah, what they have is a harness, and NASA has a big harness like this too, where they robotically support the weight of your body so that you can move around in a way that imitates low gravity. And I used a clip from them to design the animation for walking on the moon. And more recent technology apparently makes a big difference to this. They have feedback mechanisms so that computers are constantly adjusting how the harness is supporting you, so that even though you're moving normally, it maintains the sensation of being in low gravity. really interesting. I'd love to get on that thing.
Absolutely. And you're going to be making a presentation at Space Access, correct?
Yeah, you know, it's a really hardcore tech crowd, really right in the industry, right at the forefront. So I'm happy to take whatever little spot they can give me. I mean, it's not that I don't think Moonwise is important, but it's a different kind of thing. I think it'll be important to people who are there, but it's out in left field while they're out in right field. I'm really looking forward to being there. The lineup is just stacked. I think it's going to be great.
What else is on your mind?
Well, you know, the overview effect is interesting to me. It always has been. For me, it plugs into my experience in meditation. You know, I've been trained in that quite a bit, and I do it every day. And the key, as far as I can see, to good concentration when you're meditating is good posture. And that posture means that you balance your torso in such a way that you maintain yourself very straight and upright without having to use more than a very minimum amount of muscle power to do so, by using the bones of your spine to support your weight. Well, that's what astronauts are living in all the time. They don't have the kind of compression and torsion that people normally have, and the way they normally stand and sit, always doubled over, always having tension in their muscles they aren't aware of. And if you're in zero gravity, you can let go of those kinds of things. And I've always suspected that may be, you know, aside from where you are, you know, which is mind-blowing in itself, but I think that might be a physical cue that helps their mind state to change and helps lead into the overview effect. So, you know, meditation is tremendously positive. And I agree with you absolutely that the overview effect is tremendously positive. However, because I've been in places where they train people to do this and train a lot of people to do this, I can tell you that there are cases where it's not a good idea for somebody to do intensive meditation because they can have a mental breakdown. So if that relationship I'm talking about is true, then what they're saying may be true.
Nobody wants to think about that, I'm sure.
Well, you know, I mean, life drives you crazy sometimes, right? I mean, I'm not saying that it's a death knell or something to be really afraid of, but it's one more thing about when you go into a completely new world, you know, things happen.
She was already being driven crazy with problems in her life. Her marriage was falling apart. She had problems with her three kids. She was involved in this crazy love triangle and having affairs, and she wasn't going to fly again. She had already flown one time. And she was on loan from the Navy. She was a Navy captain. And I personally would find it really hard, other than for the movie, trying to find a way to rationalize making the movie and make some bucks, that the overview effect had anything to do with her instability and her problems. When they had the boards, she wasn't court-martialed, but they had the Navy inquiry boards to look into all of this. They talked about how they missed a lot of red warning signals, you know, that the lady was in distress and needed help. And they were ignored. And they talked about, we need to do a better job of detecting when our people are in trouble and need help. So my hunch is that whatever caused her problem probably didn't have a whole lot to do with space, but had a lot to do with the terrestrial stresses and things that were happening in her life and in the way she was behaving. But,
well, it's true, but again, that's always the case when you have a mental breakdown. There's always, you know, it's not a meditation causes people to go crazy. It's just if you're unstable for whatever reason and nobody catches that, it can trigger it. It's, you know, that's always true.
I predict it'll be a flop of a movie. I can't imagine that there's enough of a story there to tell a movie unless they find some way to soup it up with a bunch of drama stories that are just made up to make it exciting. She was didn't do anything spectacular as an astronaut. I don't know much about her Navy career. Were the people, the other woman was a missile officer at Patrick Air Force Base in Florida. And I think the guy that she was having the affair with, who was having the affair with the other woman, was also an astronaut. So it's just, but look, professions have, have love triangles all the time. I don't know if I ever told you the story of the guest whose wife was attacking the space show for my putting him on the show to speak about his expertise. And then she started posting all sorts of horrible things on the space show blog about he ran off with his graduate
story.
And I had to go in and remove all of that from the blog and tell her that this was not the forum for her. And I'm sorry she's hurt so much by what happened. But, you know, people hurt other people. And I don't really think the astronaut corps is anything different from other professions. That's my own take on it.
Other than it's very high stress.
But other professions are high stress too. Brain surgery, cancer work, you know, something else that you're doing might be very high work. So, but it's close knit. I will say that, you know, everybody's like brother and sister together. Mm-hmm. And, they did say that Lisa was evidencing signs of instability, and everybody overlooked them or missed them. And she should have gotten help. So anyway,
well,
I think the movie will flop, and I'm not planning to see it. But if somebody does see it, I'll put them on the air if they want to tell us about it.
You know, I haven't seen a trailer for it or anything like that yet. I probably won't go look at it though, because the thing for me is it depends on the treatment of the subject. I mean, if this is about the human condition. And how hard it is to be human and deal with emotions and deal with life. It's not sensationalist, but it's sensitive to human nature. Then examinations like that in a movie can be really interesting. And sometimes I like those movies a lot. They rarely do well at the box office. But seeing a few movies like that in your lifetime, it can be the ones you remember the most.
Well, I thought the trailer sucked, so there wasn't anything about it that would make me want to go see that film, and not even the fact that I reported on the story for several weeks is that it was a, I hate to use the word popular, but there was a lot of humor with the story that was, you know, dark humor, which I kind of love, but that was going around with the story. But anyway, I doubt that they'll do well with the movie, but it's out there for those of you that want to follow it up. And as I said, if you see the movie and you want to give us a movie report, I'm happy to take your call. But I won't be seeing it. Kim won't be seeing it. So
I might.
Oh, you might? Well, then call in and tell us what you think of it. I'll bet Frank White won't be seeing it. So what else? You're coming on the space show on the 12th, next Friday, less than
yep.
a week away.
Yeah. Yeah, I generally remind my coding team, who've been working very, very, very hard, that, you know, it would be nice if they had the code done by then so I could have the demo up on the website. People can look at it beforehand. But, you know, I have to sing their praises. You know, you always have to. It's a great learning experience for me of how you try to look after your people and you know, they're not volunteers, but they aren't getting paid very much because this is all on a shoestring right now. And they do this mostly out of interest in the kind of project that it is. And it's a very complicated undertaking, and I appreciate that more and more as time goes on. So but the bottom line there is that hopefully there will be a demo posted before that show where people can go into the colony and be there with other people. The idea is that it's a place where many people can be there at once, and you can see each other and you can talk to each other and share the experience. And that's the underlying push of Moonwords, is to create a platform where people can collaborate and exchange ideas while they're in an environment that helps them understand what it will be like for us to finally live in space.
Okay. Looking forward to Friday.
Me too.
Anything else for today?
No, I'll look forward to the next person who calls.
Thank you, Kim. Bye-bye. Listeners, we are off the line. The toll-free number is 866-687-7223. We're beyond break time, but I do want to thank our second segment sponsors. I don't want to forget them. So the Space Development Network is a sponsor. Would you like to see space settlement occur within your lifetime? The Space Development Network is an online organization that allows you, the advocate, to join together with others to advance the plan for space development. And they're looking for people with a wide variety of interests and skills. It's a totally free network to join. And you can check it out at developspace.info. So please do that. And I have a quick announcement about that. As you know, the Space Development Network is run by Dr. Doug Plata. Well, Doug has gotten married today. So we congratulate Doug on the marriage. And I think he told me his bride's name was Juliana. She's from Brazil. But don't quote me on that because I have gotten names wrong in the past. But we here at the Space Show certainly congratulate Doug and his bride and wish them happiness for all the rest of their lives. And I hope that Doug is able to gently guide Juliana into being interested in space and space settlement. He's got his work cut out for him. But congratulations, Doug. And also the National Space Society is our sponsor. They do have ISDS coming up in early June, I think June through 6th through the 8th, something like that, 6th through the 9th. It's in the Washington, D.C. area. I will be there. If you're planning to be there, make sure you find me somehow. And lots of great speakers. It's in the heart of policy wonk world, so they've got people coming from the National Space Society and other groups. So make sure you definitely, absolutely want to attend if you can, and if not, pay attention to it. The Integrated Space Plan is a highly detailed development chart, and the founder of it, co-founder of it, Jay Whitner, is going to be with us a week from today. This is the flow chart, so to speak, that shows the path to becoming spacefaring, and you can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another and interact. You can buy your own copy of the plan. So check it all out at thespaceplan.com. And then don't forget that Celestis sponsors us. So they are still the only iconic pioneer and proven provider of Memorial Spaceflight Services in the world. As we face the need to assist a loved one during the final stages of their days on this planet, much of our time is spent in sadness and difficult attempts to provide at least temporary comfort. Often the discussion turns to the kind of memorial service our loved one desires. The prospect of a Celestis memorial spaceflight can bring an element of satisfaction and even hope to someone who has little to brighten their remaining days. In the words of one of their clients, I cannot express how thrilled my family was about the launch. It is truly a wonderful day. Thank you a million times over for this opportunity. And as I've told all of you, I have flown my mom and two dogs on three separate flights, and they're planning to go on the next Celestis lunar mission as well. So the Memorial Spaceflight Services is available. They launch from the Cape, from New Mexico suborbital flight, from Vandenberg. They will soon be going to the moon, and then soon also, hopefully, to deep space and to Mars. You can add some of your DNA to the symbolic ashes of your loved one and make the trip with them. So if you have any questions, log on to Celestis.com for more information. We have a caller on hold. Hello, caller. Welcome to Open Lines. How are you and where are you? Thank you for calling.
This is John of Fort Worth.
Hi, John.
Yeah, I was looking at this thing about, I guess, well, it falls into the whole Zubrin thing plus the the Mike Pence comments on the moon. I mean, it seems interesting to me, though, they're talking about getting to the moon in this time period, yet they've actually cut the funding for the SLS, and they don't seem to have any other initiative, whether it would be some other approach, such as maybe the Zubrin approach. But, I mean, you can't get there that quick unless you have, like, for instance, an actual lander program, which I don't think there is one.
Well, they're using, according to Dennis, they're going to use the EUS with United Launch Alliance. And you haven't listened to Dennis's show on Friday, have you?
No, I haven't had
yet. So there's no hardware being bent for that, but there is a design concept, and there has been work done on it. So look, that's why many people are skeptical that that timeline is valid. That and yeah. and the partisanship that came up when Michael Listener called us earlier.
I mean, even if somebody had a real plan, it probably wouldn't be approved even just because of it. Because they want to do political opposition. It is interesting. I think the Zubrin paper itself on that, I thought that was, it is an interesting approach he's taking in that he's basically abandoning the general idea of using aerodynamic, reduction to aerodynamic drag to get back into Earth orbit and just doing a rocket, propelled insertion back into Earth orbit when coming back from the moon. It's all done with basically a lander, basically, which is an interesting idea in general. You know, I mean, I tend to think he's very optimistic in some of the paper's assumptions in terms of the masses required. I mean, it looks to me like the very paper-thin concept, like everything's got to go just right for it to work, you know. But that doesn't mean the general idea is wrong. It just may mean it may be a little bit more difficult than being suggested.
I haven't seen how popular Zubrin's idea is yet. I don't know if it's under consideration or not. But Doug called me earlier in the week to tell me about a plan that he has, which I can't possibly describe to you. And he bent the ear of Gerstenmaier with it, who put him in touch with somebody else, and I don't remember the name of the other person. And then we got to talking about his upcoming wedding plans. So, I don't know if Doug's idea is getting any play or not, but I throw that out there. Maybe at some point Doug will come back on the show, and even if his idea doesn't get any play, or dies because of no money, that he can talk about it. By the way, listeners, Doug is planning to be at Space Access. So if you're going to be at Space Access, you can see him there and ask him about his idea that he bounced off of Gerstenmaier and the other guy. I forget who Gerstenmaier turned him on to. So I don't know. I remain skeptical for mostly financial and political partisan reasons, not so much technology. If they wanted to do it, they could do it. And I agree with Dennis that it would need to be some kind of a joint program with the private sector, that if NASA's going to do it all by themselves, I don't think they'll do it.
Well, it looks like the preferred thing, Zubrin looks at a lot of options, but basically he's mainly looking at a Falcon Heavy-driven concept, I think, mainly. But the thing about these ideas, though, that he's putting out is, and a lot of other ones, which is really interesting, is the idea of trying to service and maintain a reusable vehicle like this off Earth. I mean, for instance, I'm really worried about the practical issues of maintenance, practically. I mean, how reliable is something like this going to be for multiple missions, like he's suggesting? I mean, you're in a if it doesn't work, you're dead scenario here, folks. And and I'm just wondering, can I imagine NASA committing itself to something like this? You know, I mean, not that it might not work, but it might be a thing where you're going to be taking some casualties, so to speak. You know,
Dennis, I hate to keep quoting the Wingo show from Friday, but it was really fascinating. So first of all, he believed that SLS was needed for this. and they needed to at least have two flights a year so that they could maintain skill set. But he said that down the road, with further development and a lot of experience, reusability would come into play, but not up front because it's too much to ask, kind of like what you're talking about. And he also said that you could not use existing rockets to do the moon that Dennis was talking about and that he thought Pence and Bridenstine were talking about, because they simply would require way too many flights and rendezvous and all sorts of other things. And SLS was the only one that was capable of doing this. But you'd have to scrap or reposition the gateway, change the use of it, the location of it. You know, you'd have to make some fundamental changes. But he did think SLS was essential. He didn't come down on killing SLS at all. And he did address that issue you're talking about, where reusability would be too much to handle initially, but down the road, that's where everybody would be working toward.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a good idea. I mean, I'm obviously pro reusability in general. It's just the idea that we just jump right into this initially on the first missions back to the moon, practically. I'm like, it's, you know, but yeah. Well, I mean, if you were really going to, you know, do a real moon landing approach, it would seem to me that you'd want to kind of escalate SLS Block 2 to go to the full rocket, and then also launch a, come up with some kind of a lander program, which would obviously require an increased budget, and that would allow you to do a moon mission, you know. I mean,
well,
I don't know if you could get it done that quick, seriously, considering how long SLS has taken, you know.
I don't think that's in the cards, but I suspect that the funding and the policy won't be there when it comes time to have the actual budget in place for 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And whether they could do it on a continuing resolution, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, it's really strange to me that they would take that position publicly without really having a real plan to do it. But,
well,
I mean, that's a pretty aggressive time schedule. I mean, heck, I mean, Kennedy gave himself to the decade without, or something. I mean, I'm saying.
Well, this is half a decade, roughly. But
yeah.
It is a pretty aggressive time. Look, again, if they had the funding and they really wanted to move heaven and earth to do it, they could probably do it. But I don't think the commitment is there to the degree that they can make it happen in that time scale. I hope I'm wrong. I would love to see it.
I'd like to see them do it. But it is, and so this ends up getting back into another, you know, one of these, I don't know, the ongoing gateway debate and all that sort of thing. But I always thought the gateway thing is just kind of a, this is what we can do with what we have kind of approach, rather than a, you know, what you call it, causes a lot of dissension naturally, but, you know.
Any other comments you want for today?
I think that'll be it for today. We'll see what else anybody else has to say. But I do think the general idea is an interesting concept of just doing, you know, some sort of a vehicle. I just don't know how you service it in space. I mean, you know what I'm saying? That's a very difficult project, you know.
The Zubrin idea, how do you service it in space?
Yeah, in other words, you have a vehicle that can go from Earth orbit to land on the moon and then refuel on the moon and come back to Earth orbit. And you're going to theoretically reuse this thing time and time again, right?
Right.
Well, how do you maintain its reliability in that environment? I mean, how do you, unless you just are confident it can go through, you know, 10 sorties or 5 sorties or whatever before it's just thrown away, you see what I'm saying? Well, the shuttle, you had an incredible amount of, well, that's an extreme case, but you see what I'm saying. You still have to verify everything is functional, safe, and reliable, because if it isn't, you've just lost a crew, right?
I mean, right.
Oh, well, I'll get off and see what else somebody else has to say, hopefully.
Thank you, John. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye. Listeners, our line is available for you if you would like to call us. Also, email. So the line is 1-866- 687-7223. And email remains Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. And there's still time if you would like to call up on any topic, and any of the ones we've been discussing, any of the ones we have not yet discussed, or something new that you think you would like to introduce to us, there is still time to do that. A couple of programs coming up that I want to run by you. Dr. Greg Autry is coming back on the show Tuesday, April 16th. He's going to be on for an hour. So he is a business professor at USC. He was an early space advisor to the Trump campaign, and he is chairing ISDC this year. So he'll clearly talk about ISDC. But I also wanted to ask him some economic questions, like, you know, how does our increasing national debt, which is pushing $23 trillion, impact our ability to have a quality space program? Or does it? You know, a lot of people just say dismiss the debt. It doesn't make any difference. I'd love to get Greg's take on that. Plus, he wrote an article in Foreign Policy a couple of days ago about China and their space program. I want to have him elaborate on that a little bit, too. When I come back from Space Access, there is a specially added Monday program. And this is a guest that was requested by Dr. Jim Logan, who many of you know is a friend of the Space Show and me. So it's a book that is a novel by a really, really famous author, Daniel Suarez, S-U-A-R-E-Z. The book is titled Delta V. And he's starting a big bookstore thing. It's promoted by a national publisher. But we got him to start his book tour with the Space Show because the book is out the next day, the 23rd. And so he's going to do a special Monday night program on it. And I'm really looking forward to that. Jeff Smith, who many of you have heard calling on the Space Show, and he has been a guest. He's an engineer in Tucson. He recently wrote a three-part series on booster rockets for the Space Review. So Jeff is on Tuesday, April 23rd. That following Friday, April 26th, we're going to Turin, Italy. This is really interesting. The guest is a very famous aerospace scientist and engineer, physicist, Umberto Cavallaro. I hope I got that right. C-A-V-A-L-L-A-R-O. So this is the year for Apollo books. We all know that. We've talked to Rod Pyle about that. But did you know that Umberto's Apollo book is the Apollo era and flights seen through various countries' postage stamps? And I've got a copy of the book, and it is fascinating and really interesting. So we're going to talk about Apollo as seen through postage stamps from around the world. April 30th is a program with Bruno Mambrini with MetroHop, which is sort of an easygoing, almost self-flying city transportation airplane. So you can go to MetroHop website, Google MetroHop, and you'll see the video and you can see about it. Marcia Smith on NASA's budget is on Friday 3rd. We've been talking a little bit about Marcia today. Open Lines is May 5th. Bob Zimmerman is on May 7th. Madhu is back to talk about his moon track at ISDC. And Zubrin is on. He has a new book out, but he'll also be talking about, I'm sure, his article. And he is on May 14th. Linda Spilker returns. She's our Cassini contact, and we're going to talk about winding up Cassini. Emily Carney is on May 19th, and she founded Space Hipsters. We're going to talk Space Hipsters. Phil Metzger is back with us on many of his projects, which are so very cool, May 21st. Another author who is very well-known and respected with a book, Shoot for the Moon, May 28th, James Donovan. And then we're going into dates where we have a lot of free dates yet when we have a book. I will say that Rand Simberg and Bill Simon are coming on Sunday, July 21st, the day after July 20th, with Ebola Terra. But it'll be some kind of a special Ebola Terra. It won't be, at least our thinking is right now, it won't be the typical type of Ebola Terra program we've been doing. That's what we have coming up. I'm not sure that there is anyone else out there wanting to give us a call. We are at a 90-minute program, which is our traditional spatial program, and I'm not seeing emails coming in. So if you do want to get a call in, you need to do so real quickly. Otherwise, we'll log off at a regular length spatial program. This is a full week of spatial programming. When we go to Space Access, the only program will be Greg's, and then we're gone for Space Access and Easter. We do have a call. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Good afternoon, David. This is Gene over in Pasadena.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. I was listening to your other callers today, and I know that in the past you've talked about a lot of people that, you know, talk about good ideas but aren't really doing much to move them forward, or at least not as much as maybe they could. I'm doing something here that I think is going to have a pretty broad impact on space budgets and space projects. Back in the 90s and the early 2000s, I wrote quite a few op-ed pieces for newspapers around the country about commercial space and how the shuttle could be the sort of the linchpin of a commercial space industry. And commercial space stations could be tied into that. The shuttles would be the trip up and down. But, of course, that all faded away here when the shuttles were retired. But I was pretty good at it. Normally, when you write an op-ed like that out of the blue and send it off to a publication, a newspaper or a magazine, there's only about a 10% chance that they get picked up. Well, about 70% of mine did get picked up. And half of those, the editors called me back and asked me to expand the piece so that it would fit in their Sunday issues. And this was, you know, the Houston Chronicle and the Orlando Sentinel and Seattle Times and those kind of things. So I've got that skill set. One of the ones I wrote in the very early 2000s ended up with the New York Times being reviewed, being just kind of looked over by William Broad, who was their science writer back then, space and science writer. And he called me back and was very complimentary on the way it was written, which I found very encouraging. But he says, you know, you got to write about something that people care a little bit more about than space. He said, why don't you write about the environment? He said, you'd be very good at that. So I didn't really care about, you know, environmental stories. Space was the thing that I really enjoyed writing about. I was doing that all this part-time while I was working at my regular, you know, day jobs. So I'm writing one now that'll be finished in about a week that I'm submitting to the political papers, not the science and technology papers. And it ties, first time I called you about almost a year ago now, I said that I thought one of the reasons that space has not really been picked up by a broader group of supporters outside of the space community is that it's a standalone program. Politicians don't see any real benefit to them coming out of this. The only time there was a real political angle to any kind of space development was the Apollo program. And once that was over, it was just kind of a polite nod and, you know, a few billion dollars that they threw into it for the shuttles and Skylab and that. So I take solar power satellites, which in my mind are 90% ready to go now, and I tie it into the Green New Deal. And the issue with the Green New Deal is that it's getting a tremendous amount of criticism now, and that will pick up after Earth Day, the end of this month. when you have all these people marching around saying we got to save the planet, save the planet. But of course, they don't have any practical way to do it. So the Democrats in general have gotten behind the Green New Deal without giving a lot of thought about how you're going to implement it. The Democratic presidential candidates and the Democrats in the House. So I tie these two things together and explain how solar power satellites could be not just a solution for America as far as reducing carbon emissions, but a worldwide solution that would largely be built by the United States. And the two things that really trigger the interest points in this now compared to even a year ago when I first called you, I think, are the Green New Deal, all the commitments that have been made to it, and now the problems they're having trying to figure out how to implement something that, you know, by some estimates might cost $100 trillion, a hugely unrealistic number. But the Democrats have committed to it now. So I tie the two together and explain how these solar power sats could be developed in the United States with existing technology. And I say the pathway would be to launch a demonstrator first and get it up into orbit to prove that the signals can actually come down from orbit, although they've been extensively tested on the ground. The second thing would be to launch the SLS with a second stage that could be attached to the ISS and have that converted into a assembly facility to build these photovoltaics in low Earth orbit and eventually build it into quite a larger structure that would be boosted up to geosync orbit. And by the way, that same sort of repair facility or construction facility could be used for some of what Zubrin is talking about, like you just mentioned, one of your callers just mentioned. How are you going to repair these things when they come back to the moon into Earth orbit and then back to the moon? Well, this could be another place for it. And I don't think there would just be one. I think there would be several of these structures that would start out being attached to the ISS, could be freestanding, and they could have some of the Bigelow units attached to them. But you're going to need, if you're going to look at, you know, large-scale solar power satellites, you're going to need a lot of construction facilities in basically low Earth orbit to get them put together and then boost them up to higher orbit where they're going to operate. And I extend it out even further by saying, well, you're going to start off with building these things in low Earth orbit, but then your the most practical way to do it would be to eventually build them, say, 20 years out on the moon and push them back into geosync orbit from the surface of the moon. I explain why that's feasible. Now, this isn't a technical paper. This is really more political because it talks about how the politicians that have been backing the Green New Deal are having trouble now coming up with a reasonably cost way to have something on that scale started. And I say that, you know, it'd take a bump in NASA's budget to do this, and all of those bumps would start with the House as far as increases in their budget goes, which is controlled by the Democrats now. But I said, you know, I explain how small NASA's budget is now, how tiny it is compared to the rest of the federal budget. And I say, you know, if you put an extra $10 billion into NASA's budget and gave them the charge to do this, that they could do it. They could do it on a pretty tight schedule, get something up, getting one of the larger solar sats up by, say, 5 to 6 years from now. And I point out that China, a month ago, has already made the kickoff of doing that. They say they want to get into solar power sats because it's a $2 to $3 trillion worldwide industry right now, and it's going to be $5 trillion by the middle of the century. So it walks the readers through the sort of the politics of this and how most of the Democrats that are running for president have a connection with Congress. They're senators, or some of them, like Tim Ryan, are congressmen. And almost all of them are on panels that could have an impact on this. And I say that it wouldn't be a NASA project as an ongoing program. It would start off like this. They'd put up the demonstrator. They maybe hook up the assembly unit to the ISS, and they would very, very aggressively go after setting up something on the moon that would eventually be able to produce these things. So it would support what Pence and what Pence has been talking about. Now, going back to the moon quickly, most of the panels in the House and certainly in the Senate have congressmen and senators on them that have subcontracts for the SLS in their district. So the Republicans, I think, would get on board this because it would force NASA eventually to be able to launch 6, 7, 8, 10 SLSs a year, which would be a huge job generator for all of the SLS states. So it goes over that, and Amy Klobuchar, for instance, is running for the president. She's a senator that's on the Space Committee, and I was watching her a month ago when she had Bridenstine there, and she was really pressing him to make sure that America took a leadership position in space and kept that leadership position. And Ted Cruz is on that same committee, and he's trying to figure out some way to keep the ISS going past 2024. And this would do it. And Senator Wicker is the head of that committee. He's from Mississippi, where the engines for the extra SLS flights would all be tested. So, you know, I talk about all the political tie-ins here that could be done, and I say that the industry that would likely, the most likely industry to pick that up would be the oil industry, because they're under a tremendous amount of pressure now to get out of the oil and gas industry over the next 20, 30, 40 years. And most of the oil companies are buying renewable energy companies. They're buying companies that build electric car chargers. Some of them are buying offshore wind farms. Some of them are actually buying utility companies in other countries. They spend, each of the big oil companies spend $25 to $30 billion a year with a B on exploration and new development. So to them, spending $2 or $3 billion to start supporting solar power satellites is not a big deal. But since they're under pressure from their investors to get out of the oil and gas industry over time and move into something else, and it's the investors that drive those companies, this would be the way to do it. So they wouldn't get any resistance from Trump, because the jobs that would be generated inside the United States would be enormous. And I'm sure he would shrug and say, well, if you guys think that this is going to solve the problem of climate change, which he doesn't think is actually there, and neither do I, but he could say, I'll take the jobs, you know, and go ahead and approve it if it passed through the House and the Senate this summer. So anyhow, I'm doing that. I think I've got a very good shot at getting it published in the next month or so. And it'll trigger this type of discussion about how this could, you know, the economic impact these could have on America, how it could tie into what Ocasio-Cortez is talking about, raising the minimum wage. I talk about what happened in Saudi Arabia when they only controlled 10% of the oil market, how they were able to pay everybody in their country, all the citizens of their country, not just free college and free health care and, you know, cheap gasoline at 10, 25 cents a gallon, but also they subsidized them all, and they offered them all government jobs that were often no-show jobs. You didn't have to show up. And Alaska, I talked about the success they had with energy when they didn't have any income taxes up there, and they were actually giving checks to all their residences, all their state residences, for $2,000 to $3,000 a year. North Dakota had the same thing when they were going, when their oil boom started. They were paying, you know, people who work at McDonald's $20, $25 an hour, and they couldn't get enough of them. So that could ripple across the United States if the U.S. staked out a position as being the world leader in solar power satellite production and operation over the rest of this century, really, because China and India and the others wouldn't start catching up for 20, 25 years. We could have something up in 5 years. Anyhow, it's an effort that I'm pushing that I think has got a very good chance. I talked to a few people at these publications, and they said, oh, yeah, we're looking forward to seeing it. And I tell them, the congressmen, that if they're interested in this, they get more information on solar sats from John Mankins or from the National Space Society. I route them over there. Those guys, I'll give them the technical details. And let's see if something can't get started that way to address what you were just talking about, the fact that there's not enough budget to do anything in space. This would do that.
Well, the reason there's not enough budget is not because the money's not available. It's because they choose not to spend the money that way.
This is
not an economic constraint. It's a political constraint.
That's exactly right.
So whether what you're proposing or not works, I don't have a clue. I couldn't even begin to offer you an opinion on it. I suspect that writing an article isn't going to move anybody to do anything, and that activism requires something different in this country. Most people don't even read. So I don't know that you will. You might get your article published, and if you do, I hope you will send it to the show and we can post it on a relevant blog, or you can come on as a guest and talk about it. And I would certainly welcome that. But I think you're going to be disappointed if you think posting an article will get a discussion started.
Well, I think it'll trigger something in the political circles, and that's space solar power, space in general, has never made it, as you often said, never made it into politics.
It's made it. It doesn't hold up because of the economics and some of the other stuff. It doesn't hold up for a political discussion unless you want to do what California is doing, which is so politically raise the cost of conventional power and put people on brownouts and say the way around this is then to take space solar power. Then, you know, people might buy it because the government has interfered with the market supply and pricing of terrestrial economics. And that's what's happening in California right now. You've got guys running the power for Los Angeles and San Francisco planning on brownouts this summer. And it's not because the power is not available. It's because they don't want to take it from fossil fuels and renewables can't do it. So it's totally politically engineered. So if you want to politically engineer to space solar power by tampering with the market of how power is created and transferred and delivered, you can do that, and you could probably make anything cost-effective then, because the government could raise the price of anything to, $1 million a kilowatt, for example, unless you buy it from this source over here, which is $100 a kilowatt hour. So,
You're right. The electricity costs in California are 50% higher than, you know, Nevada or Arizona or the other.
But that's political. So that's right. So if the U.S. government wants to engineer political barriers to economic electricity to favor subsidizing an industry, I suppose they could do that if they could pass the laws and withstand the legal challenges. But I'm just suggesting to you that if you want to move heaven and earth, it takes more than writing an article.
No, I don't know.
Then report back on me. You've got a chance to prove my statement erroneous.
I know.
You know, because I'm not hindering you from writing your article. And, in fact, when and if you do get it published, I want you to present it in detail, either as a guest on the Space Show or at least post it on one of our blogs or a show so we can discuss it with you in more detail, and I welcome that opportunity. But I think you've got a real uphill path to the top of the mountain to climb.
Well, if it was a year ago, I would say yes, but I think that Green New Deal proposal has gotten so many Democrats panicking now because they're realizing that is nowhere near going to be, you know, be anything resembling feasible. I think that they would be open to looking at this. And, the last thing I heard from Mankins, the last piece I saw from him, he says that he's got it down to where he could prove with his documentation that the electricity would be about 5 cents a kilowatt hour at the ground when it hits the antennas on the ground. That's as cheap as coal.
And how much traction does he have for that?
I don't think he's talking to the right audience.
Well, you may be right, but he's been talking for 25 years.
He has,
and I don't know. Does the Trump administration have a science advisor, and does the science advisor entertain this? I know that previous science advisors wouldn't hear of space solar power because they favored nuclear and other kinds of energy. But I don't even know if the Trump group has a science advisor that you could try to sell on something like this.
Well, I think the Space Council would be the one to sell it to, but I think it has to be sold in the House first, because that's where the budget starts. and they're the most desperate. You know what the politicians say about never wasting a crisis.
But that's shallow. They're paying lip service to that. But if they got into a real campaign, they're not going to tout the Green New Deal because it's ridiculous. But
it is ridiculous.
I'm trying to find the Trump science advisor if he actually has one. I don't think he has one.
I don't think so either. But you know, anything that comes out of Trump is going to be resisted.
Wait, he does have one. Hold on. Can Trump's new science advisor convince him that climate change is real? Okay,
yeah.
So I'm just looking for a name. Okay, in the 11th hour of the outgoing Congress and Senate, Kevin Drogemeier, a meteorologist and former University of Oklahoma professor, was confirmed to be the director of Office of Science and Technology Policy on Wednesday. This was in 2018. So he does have a science advisor, Kelvin Drogemeier, Drogemeier, a meteorologist from University of Oklahoma, Boomer Sooner. So he does have one.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think...
So you should include sending him a copy of your article.
Yeah, I would. And I'll get it to the other players also.
It's the Office of Science and Technology.
If it pops up in the right publication inside the Beltway, one of those that is read by everybody, you know, every morning, I think it'll trigger them. It's not going to change their mind, but it'll say, well, let's take a closer look at this. And I think they'll reach out to somebody on the Space Council and say, what do you guys know about it? Or more even likely is the National Space Society or Mencken, somebody that, you know, they look at and they say, well, he's not political. He's not tied to Trump. But let's hear a little bit more about this. And they'll give him the technical stuff and say, yeah, it's all feasible. He just needs extra money to do it, but it can be done in fairly short order. So anyhow, you know how politicians are. They don't particularly have to back something that they think will work. They just have to back something that they think is going to get them votes.
Are you going to ISDC? Because they have a space solar power venue at ISDC.
No, I am bogged down with other things that I've got here in California. This is part of it, and there's another project that I'm working on.
Well, send us your article when you get it published, and if you want to do a full space show program, I'm happy to do it with you.
Oh, I'd be happy. Yeah, that'd be good.
So
anyhow,
keep us posted.
I'll rewind here.
I wish you luck.
You know that, yeah, there's not, everybody is not just kind of sitting back and talking about it. A few of us are really doing something. Quite a few of us.
I wish you luck.
Right.
And listeners, if you have comments for him, post them on the blog because he'll check it and he'll see what you're thinking. All right. Have a great rest of the Sunday. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. And so, listeners... That call is through, and the phone is already ringing again. Wow. This is going to be a two-hour show. Hold on, everybody. Welcome to the show. Who are you, and where are you? Thank you for calling Open Lines.
Hi, I'm your 11th hour caller, John in Fremont.
John in Fremont, going to Space Access. How you doing?
I'm doing okay, David.
Are you ready for... a break in California electrical prices for space solar power?
I doubt if they'll do that. But they'll do a brownout, I'm sure.
Well, they're planning on them for at least Los Angeles. Probably San Francisco too. But anyway, vote with your feet, which means you cross the border. What's on your mind?
Well, I was going to mention a paper that came out in reviews in human space exploration, the Reach Journal. But you mentioned that Phil Metzger is coming on the show. I don't want to steal his thunder. I think this is the paper. He's an author, plus many. Of your space show guests are contributors to this paper. It's on a propellant production architecture for the moon, and it's a very, very detailed paper proving feasibility of a robotic system to create architecture for lunar propellant and it could definitely support, you know, cislunar operations, Gateway, lunar landers, going to Mars, everything. So it's pretty good paper, and I think Phil Metzger probably will talk about it. I don't want to steal his thunder. So
well, he's not on for quite a while. What did I say? He's on in July or June or something like that.
Yeah. Well, I can post the paper to the blog if you want.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
It'll give you an advanced look at it.
Yeah. May 21st is when Phil is on, so 2 months away, a month away.
And then the other thing is I had mentioned in an email to you, there's going to be an announcement coming out on Wednesday by the Event Horizon Telescope, which is attempting to create, well, they've already created a Earth-sized aperture radio telescope to detect black holes, the actual event horizon activity around a black hole. And they have a big announcement coming up that they have some results to report. I don't know what it is, so it's a tickler, and I'm pretty excited to find out what it is. And that's going to be on Wednesday this week.
All right.
And I can post that press release on the blog as well.
Yeah, put that up on the blog as well, too.
Okay.
What else is on your mind?
That's it.
Okay. Looking forward to seeing you and your wife for dinner Wednesday evening. I guess we'll have to work that out as we get closer.
Yeah, it is kind of late for dinner that evening, so, you know, if that doesn't work out, that's okay.
Yeah, well,
you know, I know.
Yeah, it's not going to be early because of the plane and BART schedules.
Right. We're going to have to pick up Kim at the BART station.
Or I'll pick her up and meet you guys wherever, if that works. But I doubt that based on SFO schedules and BART travel times, which I know nothing about, it's at least 7 p.m., maybe a little later. I don't know.
You don't have to worry about picking her up because you're gonna be navigating down to the hotel anyway. You'll probably be down there by then, but I know where the BART station is, and I can easily do that. I'll be there.
Okay, there's two of them in Fremont, so you guys need to be on the same page that she's going to the correct one.
Yeah, well, there's only one in Fremont, and there's one in Union City, which is not Fremont, but it's north Fremont.
GPS had two listed for Fremont.
Oh, maybe there's a south one now.
Yeah, South Fremont.
I have to look at that.
Yeah, okay. South Fremont. And the other day when I was looking at them and to see travel time, and it was around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so it was almost 2 hours to go to the one that we think you're talking about, and it's only 8 miles, and the other one was 4 miles and was 45 minutes. So something must have happened to the freeway because that's outrageous travel time for such a short distance.
Yeah. When is Kim's plane getting in?
That Wednesday.
Yeah, when? Yeah.
I don't know. I'll let her. I don't want to put that out over the air. I'll let her communicate that with you by email. But
okay.
I know she goes through SFO is all I really know. So she takes BART from SFO. To the East Bay, you probably have to change, but I've not been on BART, so I don't know how that works. But I suspect I will be at the hotel by mid-afternoon because I'm going to do my best to avoid traffic.
Yeah, I would do that myself.
You know, I have enough of it in Petaluma to last me a lifetime. So if I can avoid that driving to Fremont... I did look up at the middle of the night. I figured there's absolutely no traffic between Petaluma and Fremont in the middle of the night. So at 2 a.m., I looked up on GPS to see what the travel time was. And it was an hour and 14 minutes. So
I
figured that's the best that I could ever do. And anything after that is traffic delays. So we'll see how it works. But... If that's all I need, all I have facing me, that's pretty good. So hopefully it won't be much worse than that. But who knows? You never know until the day of the drive. And anyway, listeners don't need to hear this crap. So, anything else on your mind for space?
No, that's it, David. Looking forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks.
Likewise, and everyone else at Space Access, too. Okay, thank you, John. Take care.
Right. Bye-bye. Bye.
A little personal business there, listeners. I apologize for that. We're at a two-hour show. If anybody else wants to call, I'll hold the line open. 1-866-687-7223. I know it takes a couple of minutes for you to hear my voice once I say it because of all the conversion times the software goes through. Otherwise, we'll wind it up for open lines today. And our next program is, again, Tuesday. On Tuesday, Mike Gruntman is with us from USC about the first spaceports ever. And he's going to be talking about the history and some of the facts around Baikonur. And he has posted a really interesting thing for you to read, his paper, which is pre-publication. He's allowed to distribute it free for a short period of time. So check it out. It's already on the blog page for his show on Tuesday evening. So you don't want to miss out on that. Okay, it looks like we're not going to get any additional calls for today, so we will have a two-hour no-break open lines program. So I want to thank everybody who called and participated. And for the rest of the weekend, please have a good one and take it easy, and we thank you. So if you want to reach any of the people who have called the show today, please email me, and I can forward your email to the people. And post your comments on the blog, if you have any. And we thank you for listening. So, again, goodbye from all. Goodbye from David and the Space Show. And do keep looking up.